Hello again, and welcome to Authors Audio, where we interview authors from around the world. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. And today we'll be speaking to George Doherty, the author of Crisis Intervention Training for Disaster Workers. George is a therapist and has a master's degree in psychology. He spent 11 years flying for the Wyoming Civil Air Patrol as a squadron commander in disaster relief. He has also served in the Red Cross in similar capacities. He is the writer of other books, The Counseling of Responders After 9/11 and Counseling Firefighters and Their Families. George is the founder and president of the Rocky Mountain Region Disaster Mental Health Institute, which promotes the practice and training of field workers in disaster mental health interventions. He lives and works in Laramie, Wyoming, and it's a pleasure for me to introduce George Doherty to our program. Hello, George. How you doing?
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. Okay, to get started, George, you have compiled a very complete book, Crisis Intervention Training for Disaster Workers. It's an excellent textbook for the study of the elements of disaster response, focused especially on how victims and responders react psychologically to disaster events. I assume you use this book in your training classes, am I right?
It originally started actually as a text for a graduate class. So.
Your background, I gather you're a psychologist and teacher. You even spent time in the U.S. Air Force. Could you give our listeners a brief introduction into what led you into specializing in this field and writing the book?
Well, okay, a number of things. I flew search and rescue missions for over 11 years with Civil Air Patrol in Wyoming here for one. And the other one, I've spent quite a few years with the Red Cross deploying for national disasters and other things like that in crisis situations. And my mental health background experience working in rural areas in places like Nevada and Colorado and Wyoming, one thing led to another, and started building up a background and experience and activities in these areas, and decided that this would be a good area to do some work in.
Well, there certainly is enough emergencies and disasters to go around the world today. George, in your lexicon, what's the difference between a disaster and an emergency?
Well, I guess, yeah, you could probably say that disaster is probably something that's more widespread, is a better way to distinguish that. An emergency is something that occurs, with a smaller situation, for example, a car accident or somebody falls and hurts themselves or something, a drowning situation, something like that. A disaster would be something that affects a larger number of people and over a broader geographic area in most cases.
I'm interested in our listeners, most who would not be first responders to a disaster, but what can an average person do to prepare for disaster situation in their immediate community, or how can they help?
Well, preparing is always important, and there are a number of groups and organizations and agencies out there that provide guidelines for such things. The American Red Cross has pamphlets and preparation things. They can prepare by that way. Emergency management agencies usually do that, and in our state out here, I know our Homeland Security has little spots they put on TV and send out pamphlets about how to prepare and what to look for and how to, keep people together and contact people and things like that.
I suppose my gut feeling tells me that when something dramatic happens or overwhelming, that a lot of people just tend to lose it. They don't really know what to do. At that moment in time, even though they might know if they were just sitting down and talking about it.
If you're talking about a victim, for example, of a disaster, and if it's an overwhelming situation, quite often you might find them a little bit dazed or a little bit, taken back by it in such a way that they are not exactly knowing how to act or what to do next or where to go. And that's where it's important, I think, for someone who is a responder, whether they are a mental health professional or a responder of any type, to help them, give them some sort of guidance in what to do and where to go, and something very specific to give them, back to them, some sense of control over the environment or control over their own lives at that point. Because, for example, an earthquake, flood, or major fire, something like that, that comes on real quick, people tend to get a little bit dazed with that and then not sure exactly of how to respond. So some guidance is helpful.
What people would normally constitute a disaster response team?
Okay, on for example, on our critical incident stress management teams, we usually have what we call peers, who are first responders, who are firefighters, EMTs, law enforcement, mental health, and you know, various other types of responders. And we kind of split them between what we call peers and mental health responders. And it's important to have that mental health component in there. And those people that are on the CISM teams, for example, are specifically trained on how to respond to these incidents and to work with the responders. They can also, in many cases, if asked, work with victims too. But primarily, their goal is to work with responders.
George, you mentioned the many emotional stages of stress that people can go through after a shock of a disaster: depression, grief, anger, mm-hmm. guilt, apathy, and fear. These are all levels of stress,
right?
People actually need quite a bit of help through, correct?
Yeah, and this is we're looking primarily there when you're speaking of those at the victims, although that can also happen with responders if it's an really overwhelming event. You know, for example, 9/11 would be probably a good example of that, where, you know, things are just kind of shocking everybody.
And of course, every disaster is very, very different, with like you say, different types mm-hmm. of responses needed. I'm thinking of Katrina and all that brought about. And there was certainly a lot of anger around that incident, in the way people perceived that it was being dealt with by the government, I believe.
Well, yeah. That's relatively kind of a normal response. It was probably a lot more so in evidence with Katrina, because of a lot of other factors and stuff involved there that were, you know, maybe political as well as otherwise, but and social. But there are certain stages that people go through. There's a model that you know, works fairly well for disasters that includes a number of phases. For example, the first phase is the heroic phase, where people would go through, you know, immediately it occurs when the impact of the disaster, and shortly thereafter. And that's when your responders and victims are helping each other and working real hard responding to things. Then you have what they call a honeymoon stage, which is usually from 1 week, 3 weeks, or to 6 months or so after the disaster, and everybody feels pretty good about things. The government's bringing in aid, other people are bringing in aid, FEMA's there, and Red Cross is there, and all the other folks, and they, you know, they feel like things are moving pretty good. And then the one that you're alluding to here, I think, is what we call the disillusionment stage. And this can last from somewhere, you know, from 2 months, depending on the disaster, from 2 months to maybe 1 or 2 years, and maybe have lingering effects longer than that. And I think that's part of what you see with some of that stuff in Louisiana and Katrina, is that, you know, some folks were disillusioned with what occurred. And like I say, there were other factors that were involved there that would take a long time to discuss. And then the final stage there is what we call a reconstruction stage, and that can last for several years. And these overlap. They're not, you know, they're not saying, okay, today's the end of the honeymoon stage, and now we go on to the next one. They can overlap and regress back and forth on certain things, you know, time-wise. The reconstruction, I think, for example, in the Katrina in the south there, has already begun. for people rebuilding and things, and it takes a long time for that to occur, sometimes 10, 15, 20 years even.
It's a long period of recovery for people who have lost homes and lost jobs and perhaps have lost their original place where they live.
Yes, and you know, that can affect the composition of a whole community. I think back I had gone down to Biloxi, Mississippi, right after Hurricane Camille years ago, because I had been stationed at Keesler prior to that, and knew some people down there. And I recall, you know, the way Biloxi was before the hurricane, and then seeing what happened afterwards. And you had a lot of development there that changed things and made actually improved the economy for the area, you know, but because it allowed those changes to occur. So sometimes that can happen. But the rebuilding of the homes is the hard part.
That's right, and getting a semblance of their life back together, and everybody wants to have it done overnight, but it never happens that way.
We want back what we just lost, you know, and of course that's not possible.
Yeah. It's not possible. Tell me why mental health professionals need extra training to be effective disaster workers, and do we have enough qualified people working in this field, do you think?
Well, the last part I can probably tell you real quick is that we never have enough, but the special training is important because it is a specialty area. And a lot of our mental health professionals, whether they are our counselors, psychologists, social workers, psychiatric nurses, or whatever type background training they have, specialize quite often in clinical areas in graduate schools, and which is good, and it's important that they have this as a basis. But then to specialize in a particular area like this takes a lot of a different type of focus. It's not an office-based thing. In other words, a mental health worker can't go to a disaster, sit in an office, and wait for people to come to him or her. There's something that I call MHEWA, and that's mental health by walking around. And basically what that means is they need to get out there, you know, in the boots and slosh through the mud and go meet the people where they're at, you know. And that takes quite a different focus, as well as, you know, understanding some of the stuff that are specific to people's reactions and disasters, such as these stages that we spoke about a few minutes ago.
George, you talk a lot about the many tasks of first responders who often have to work very long, arduous hours in possibly very dangerous conditions in disaster situations. Your book is written mainly for responders. Can you describe for us some of the major problems first responders see on the job?
I can give you a couple of examples that people are maybe seeing in the news at one time or another. I think if you recall some of the photos from the Oklahoma City bombing, the very famous photograph of the fireman carrying the child, and the child, of course, was not, you know, was dead when he was carrying her over. But these responders will react very strongly when children are involved. Another example was, of course, baby Jessica in the well a number of years ago, where she was rescued. First responders are open to some post-traumatic stress that can occur from some very severe events that, you know, from long-term things. There's about three types or more of stressors that can affect them on the job. One is the long hours, as you say, and when people work too long, too intensely over time, we tend to get tired, and we tend to make some mistakes in judgment sometimes, or in decision making, and it's hard to for a first responder to say no, I can't be here. Somebody has to say you need to take some time off and go and sleep, and be away from the scene for a while in order to refresh yourself so that you make good decisions and judgment on the job. You know, they are professionals, they know what they're doing, but even the best of us can make mistakes if we are overworked. The other type of stressors that can occur are what I call cumulative stress, and that's something that can occur over months, months, years. First responders who are there responding year after year, and with little stressors that build up. I'm an old farm boy, so I kind of put it in the sense of, like, you know, if you had a bucket under a spigot, the spigot was dripping a drop at a time. It's slowly filling up, and then you've got one little drop that causes it to overflow, and that's like stress, this cumulative stress. Okay, the event that triggers the overflow there or the reaction may be a very insignificant event, but it's added in with all this other stuff that's been in there maybe for years, and so it causes the situation to occur. And then the third one is something that's so traumatic, okay, that it causes, and this is things like war situations and like 9/11 situation or massive disaster situation in which the responder is there, and that situation causes reactions in terms that trigger events and post-traumatic stress that can occur later in terms of you know, how they respond and you know, causing reactions that may involve dreams and things. I don't know if you had the opportunity to see any of Ken Burns' The War in the last few days, but you look at some of the statements there that are made by World War II veterans, for example, all these years later, and that the dreams and stuff that some of them have and some of the reactions and the triggers. And so, you know, war is another situation that can cause those.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I recently interviewed on our program a Vietnam vet, David W. Powell, who wrote a book called My Tour in Hell, and it's a recount of his 20-year battle with the demons of post-traumatic stress disorder. He has a hair-raising story of personal abuse, mm-hmm. and job loss and marriage loss and breakups, really before he got the necessary treatment for his disorder. And that is a long period of time to go without proper treatment, for sure.
Yeah, you're right. You know, I don't know if there is a silver bullet answer to it of any kind, because each situation is a little bit different. But talking about it helps, and talking about it, same with disaster victims, talking out things, knowing what to expect is less threatening over time. I think, for example, if some of our Vietnam veterans had been aware many years ago that they could expect to have, you know, some bad dreams, for example, or some other triggers, they at least might be able to explain where it's coming from, rather than be scared by it and not know why it's there or why it's happening.
I have seen in many instances of disasters and so on where after the fact is that many people have stayed in contact with others who are involved in the disaster, and that seems to be a very helpful way to not only remember what happened, but to also help people to deal with the future and the present.
The best thing over time, and this is what I try to get across in the courses that we teach on this, is to everyone, and that is that this event's now part of your life, okay? It's not, like you say, it's not going to go away. The memories and the thoughts are going to be there, and they're going to be intrusive over time for the rest of your life, okay? However, what's important is that, you know, how do you respond to that? How do you explain it to yourself? And how do you deal with it? Because that you do have control over.
I imagine shortly that we're going to see much more evidence of all kinds of psychological trauma as more and more troops return from what's been 5 or 6 years of war in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah, there's a very good healing process that goes on there because they have shared this together. It's an event, you know, tragic as it is. There's a bond that's there that they have gone through this together. They are the ones that know what that event was about because they were there. And you'll find that among people for families in plane crash victims and the families of victims there that will get together, you know, over time on anniversaries and such. Again, the military is a very, very good example of that. The units that, you know, they share that because, and we're going to be experiencing a good deal of that with our troops as they return. A lot of them with physical injuries, but a lot more with the injuries that are going to be things that we'll have to deal with in the community and that they have to deal with over time.
This trauma is going to last a whole lot longer than a lot of the physical injuries that some of these soldiers have endured, for sure.
Yes, and again, I say, like I said before, you can see some evidence of that from our World War II veterans who are beginning to, a lot of them that spoke out in the Ken Burns series, where they are relating some of the events that they occurred to them, and you can tell by just watching and listening, you know, to the tone in their voice and stuff, even just watching it on the TV, that they are still there, still thinking about it, you know, very strongly. It still affects them. They found ways to deal with it in their regular lives, but it's still there. You know, and I think that's going to happen a lot with our folks coming back, and I think they're going to be also a little bit more aware of how to deal with it too. I think the military is trying very hard, you know, prepare them for this, and especially our guard units. We work with our guard units here in Wyoming, for example, the family service people to. You know, they do a very good job of trying to mitigate a lot of that.
Yes. I know you touch in your book about some extra understanding on how children or the elderly deal with these disasters as well. Of course, for troops coming home, it affects the whole family, too, and they need help.
Yeah, you're right. The family, I think, is a major key here in being supportive and being understanding. I was watching, and I don't recall where I saw this now, but it was with one of the troops coming back from Iraq, who his wife was noticing some changes while in her communications back and forth with him. And so she went to seek some help about it because she was aware about this, to prepare for how she should deal with this. And when he came back, she and he have been going to counseling over time and working with this. And from what I saw on the video that I saw with this, it was, you know, helping out considerably for him to and her in their marriage. And I think that's important. The family is important in this, and they need to know how to handle it.
I couldn't agree more, George.
And, you know, if you're looking at war situations, for example, that was one of the things out of World War II when everybody came back. The families were there. They were supportive. They were working with them. You know, they were understanding about what the situation was for the most part. And the same with disasters and any kind of an incident that is a traumatic incident. The family is the primary support group. There are other groups out there that can help as well, but that's the primary one.
Yes, it is. Now, you're having a conference coming up in November, I understand.
Yes, we try to do an annual conference on disaster mental health. It'll be in Cheyenne, Wyoming, November 8th through the 10th. And we have some people from different parts of the country that come and from other countries. We have, for example, one presenter coming from London. She's done work over in South Asia in follow-up to the tsunami. She's reported to us for the last 3 years, right after the tsunami, which she responded to. And now she's been doing some follow-up with the children and families over there. We have people from from the rural west here who will be providing information and stuff that's relevant to this area here. So we have a, you know, usually very good, very interesting presentations and conferences. With our keynote speaker this year is Lieutenant Colonel Sherry Jones, and she is the CISM, Critical Incident Stress Management person for the Civil Air Patrol nationally. I'm looking forward to her presentation there. So just another thing here too, we publish the proceedings usually afterwards, the papers and stuff. You know, we ask people to write a paper about their presentation, so we have that for future.
Where can people get a hold of you, George? I know you have a website and also a newsletter.
The best place for them to go is, that's RMR Institute, all one word, .org. And there should be links on there that can take them directly to the brochure, which we have online for the conference. You'll see, they'll see something there that'll say, you know, 6th Annual Rocky Mountain Region Disaster Mental Health Conference. And if they just click on that, it'll take them to the brochure.
Well, once again, I'd like to thank George Daugherty, the author of Crisis Intervention Training for Disaster Workers, for coming on Authors Audio today. And remember, you can reach George at his website at www.rmrinstitute.org, or also by phone at 307-399-4818, and that's Mountain Time. And just a reminder that George is holding his 6th annual Rocky Mountain Region National Disaster Mental Health Conference this year, November the 8th through the 10th at 2007. And until next time, this is Jake D. Steele saying, happy reading.